Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's up to us, every single one of us, to not only be improving our behavior towards each other, but to be demanding a different sort of politics, a different sort of social structure. And that, I think, can happen.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss everything to do with food, lifestyle, medicine. And this week, we're going to be discussing basic income as a measure that could alleviate societal suffering. Now, in light of the evolving pandemic, I wanted to shift the conversation from reacting to the current scenario to considering what opportunities there are to grow from this. In the same way, the British public and government created a universal healthcare system in the wake of World War II, the NHS, perhaps our current scenario provides the foundation for even more radical thinking. And so this week's podcast, I actually speak with Professor Guy Standing, a professoral research associate and former professor at SOAS University of London and world expert on the universal basic income. He's also co-founder and current co-president of the Basic Income Earth Network, BIEN, an international non-governmental organization that promotes basic income as a right. Now, you might be thinking, what on earth is Dr. Rupi doing talking about basic income and economical structure that doesn't exist anywhere in the world, but actually has an immense impact on livelihood, on lifestyle, on health, as we will get to in today's discussion. We discuss basic income as a reality that can actually alleviate a lot of problems that we see and I see personally in the healthcare system. And this has started years before the pandemic, but these societal inequalities have actually been accentuated and magnified as a result of the virus. What we understand more than ever is the inequality within our communities, the effects of which will last far beyond the closure of this health crisis and will probably continue unless we think more carefully and more imaginatively about how we structure our society. In today's podcast, we talk about the basic constructs of what universal basic income means, the ethical and economic arguments for basic income, and the idea and culture shifts in politics and society that need to be in place for basic income to work. We also touch upon professors' experiences with instituting basic income in different communities across the world, ranging from Latin America, India, but also Alaska and other parts of Europe as well. I also want to bring attention to Professor's book as well, the Eight Giants, or Battling Eight Giants, and what we can do to alleviate that. And he's certainly of the opinion that basic income is a public good and should be a human right. Whether you agree with that or not, it's up to you, and I invite you to make your own opinion and make your own decision by the end of this podcast. But I hope to have at least enlightened a different way of thinking and a radical way of thinking as well, because I think this is exactly what we need at this moment in time. Please do listen to the rest of the podcast. If you are interested in the subject matter, I can certainly do more in this way. And I'd love to get your opinions on what you thought of this as well. Please do send any comments and do subscribe to the doctorskitchen.com newsletter, where we give recipes every single week and other elements, lifestyle tips and tricks to help you lead the healthiest, happiest life. And do follow my guest on social media, the links of which are all going to be on the podcast show notes. There's also the video where they describe in detail the experiment that they did in India, where they gave basic income to 2,000 residents and what they found with regards to literacy rates, nutrition, and improvements in diet as well. It's quite incredible. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy this. I hope this gives you a bit of a break from the doom and gloom, and perhaps ignites in you something that you'd want to see in the future as well. Guy, it's a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you so much for your time already. I came across you because somebody sent me some audio inserts of podcasts as well, and I thought this is absolutely fascinating, and particularly as this shift in people's mentality mirrors somewhat after the World War II, where people really came together in community spirit, and perhaps this is going to lead to something as incredible as the NHS. And someone who works in healthcare and sees the benefit of universal healthcare free at the point of delivery, I was fascinated by this concept of universal basic income. Could we just kick off by, because my listeners are usually here to listen about food and lifestyle and how that translates into medicine. Can we kick off by explaining what we mean by universal basic income and where that already exists if it doesn't already?
Okay, well, first of all, good morning to you and the listeners. And let me say that I've always been a 100% supporter of the NHS, and we really respect what doctors and nurses are doing at this terrible moment. A basic income, it is a concept that I trace back to 1217 in the Charter of the Forest, which accompanied the Magna Carta on November the 6th, 1217, when it said that everybody in England, as it then was, everybody in England had the right to subsistence in the commons. Living had the right to have the means to survive, okay? And the essence of basic income is that everybody, every man and every woman equally, and every child, possibly at a lower level, should have the right to receive a modest basic income paid individually, not on a household basis. We'll come back to that later. Paid in cash or the equivalent, and guaranteed as a right. In other words, non-withdrawable. You get it as a right. And it would be without conditions. In other words, you don't have to prove your particular work status or your particular marital status or household status or amount of income you've got. And that's the controversial aspect. But the idea is that everybody should have equal access to basic resources needed to survive, to be able to pay for your food, your rent, just enough to survive, not to be in luxury, but basic security. And of course, you could pay it to everybody because that's the simplest way to get it out. Don't ask detailed questions about what you're doing and all that stuff. And if you want, you could tax it back from the rich, so that they are neither worse off nor better off. But it's much simpler to do it that way than to do what successive governments have been doing, which is targeting on people deemed to be poor, right? Once you target, you have to do means tests. And we know from generations of research in Britain and in every other country where they've tried them, that means testing, targeting on the poor has huge errors. A lot of people don't apply for the benefits. They don't know about the benefits. They're fearful, they're stigmatized, they're proud. And then you do the tests, and if someone might be poor one week and not poor another week, how do you do it? And of course, it compounds the problem because you have what we call poverty traps. If you say you will only give benefits to the poor, then someone who makes an effort to become non-poor would automatically be losing the benefits, right? That's precisely what happens with universal credit, with all other means-tested benefits. And the Department of Work and Pensions itself, not Guy Standing, it's the Department of Pensions, Work and Pensions, have said that the marginal tax rate from someone going from benefits into the sort of low-wage jobs that the precariat can get is over 80%. In other words, taking a job would only give you an extra 20% compared with the benefits you get. But it's actually worse than that, because there's also what I've called a precarity trap, which means you have to wait for your benefits if you become eligible, okay? Officially 5 weeks, but often 12 weeks, okay? And then if you took a short-term job paying that extra 20%, as it were, you would very quickly find you'd be out of that job again and have to apply and wait again to get back to the benefits. That combination is lethal. You'd be a fool to take that low-wage job. So you have your existing system is both unfair and stupid. You know the word stupid? It's early morning, but, you know, I could use stronger words. But essentially, it is stupid. Now, basic income in the current circumstances has gone from being desirable for reasons we can discuss to being absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. Because what has happened, and I discussed that in the two books that you know about. The new one just came out last month. It's called Battling Eight Giants, Basic Income Now. And it was written before the pandemic. And it basically, the arguments in my books, because the previous one had done it as well, is that because of the nature of the reforms since the era of Thatcher and Reagan, we have a very fragile economic system characterized, I'm an economist, so excuse me for a moment for a couple of technical words, characterized by rentier capitalism, not free market capitalism. And what that means is that more and more of the income that is generated in Britain or in the United States or in Europe, more and more of that income is going to the rentiers, the property owners. Physical property, as in land and houses and so on, financial properties, as all the financial assets, and intellectual property. And this in the sense of your doctor, you're a doctor. One of the scandals has been the establishment of the intellectual property rights system in the world, whereby a pharmaceutical company, if it has an invention, has a guaranteed monopoly profit for 40 years so that they can charge what they like. And that has been entrenched by giving more and more people with more and more patents, they get higher and higher income. So what this, we come back to that perhaps later, but what has happened is that we have terrifying levels of inequality. That's the first giant, right? A basic income won't reduce all poverty, but it would reduce poverty. It would, if you give everybody a base, then you automatically reduce poverty because it represents a higher percentage of the income of a low-income person than a higher-income person. But the real problem we've got is that the inequalities are creating some of the other giants that I'm going to mention. Okay.
But before we get into the eight giants, Guy, I just want to stop right there because I think this is really resonating with me personally, because I understand, being a general practitioner and someone who works in A&E, the inequalities and the vulnerability of a whole bunch of people. However, I believe that there is an idea that people who are trapped in the benefit system or choose not to go into low wage jobs are purely lazy. Now, I don't believe that whatsoever, but I really do think that there is an understanding that that is what is going on. And that's why a construct like universal basic income doesn't exist and would not work. What do you say to those kind of skeptics?
Well, I could come back to that later. I think that perspective is theoretically wrong and profoundly wrong in fact. Okay, there's a lot of evidence to show that people want to work. People want to improve their living standards. There is no evidence that laziness or benefit cheating has been pervasive. It's not true. There have always been a few, but that's never been a pandemic itself. There is plenty of evidence that we could perhaps come back to, plenty of evidence that if you give people basic security, they work more, not less. We've done pilots around the world. I've been involved in designing and testing it in various parts of the world. And when you introduce a basic income, people work more, not less. And moreover, they tend to be more productive because they're more cooperative. They've got more energy. They've got more confidence. They take more risks in being innovative. And this is a profound prejudice that out there, people don't want to improve their lives. Yeah, you can be dragged down into social illnesses and the sort of things that you know about so that you become incapable or vulnerable in a personal sense. But it is not true that most of us don't want to improve our lives or improve the lives of our children and our families. So I think that is a profound prejudice, which has been very convenient on the right, because then you can justify cutting benefits and making it harder to get and the rest of it. And then you end up with universal credit, which is causing homelessness, suicides, a lot of rising morbidity. So to me, that is pure prejudice. But let me go back to the story. Why we now need a basic income desperately, and why I'm receiving emails from people all over the world. I cannot keep up with it, right? I just cannot keep up with it. And I'm telling myself that I have a duty to be talking about it now, when for 40 years, most people would say, you're mad, you know, and suddenly I'm respectable. I'm really worried about that part, but we'll leave that aside. Besides the inequality, we have experienced, and I'm sure people listening to us will understand this, a incredible growth of chronic insecurity. Millions and millions of people feel insecure. There's a term I've used in my book on the precariat. It's called the bag lady syndrome. The bag lady syndrome. And don't think it only affects women, but it's meant to be a common nightmare that people wake up in the middle of the night worried that one mistake, one illness, one bad decision, and they could be out in the street with all their belongings in two paper bags. And that is a phenomenon. When I first wrote about it, I cannot tell you how many people have written to me saying, that's how I feel. That's how I feel, you know, or a variant of that. So insecurity is the source of illness, as you know much better than I do, right? It induces heart disease. It induces cancers. It induces alcoholism. It induces things that otherwise wouldn't reach us, cause problems to us, and shortens life. Okay, now insecurity leads to one of my ethical reasons for wanting a basic income, which is that basic security is a public good and a human need. It's a public good, as we economists call it, because you having it does not deprive me of having it. And in fact, if we all have basic security, the value to each and every one of us goes up. Because people behave better towards one another, they're more altruistic, they're more tolerant of the other, they tend to be less xenophobic. You know, all of these things have been shown by the psychologists, right? So we need basic security. A society needs basic security for resilience. And I'll come back to that keyword later. The third giant blocking the road to a good society is related, and it's debt. Now, debt for me is the trigger of the economic crisis we're going to be facing in the coming months and years. Because if you have a downturn like we're having, millions of people who have been living on the edge of unsustainable debt suddenly will find they can't service their debts. They can't pay that flipping payday loan or the credit card or the unsecured debt. They can't, and companies can't either. And there will be a pandemic of bankruptcies and all the consequences of that. We have a higher level of private debt in Britain today than at any time in our history. And it's the same in the United States, where private debt, total private debt, is 1.5 times the national income. Think about it. If you have slight downturn, boom, okay? The fourth giant is related to the previous three, and that you as a doctor will also know much better than I. It's called stress.
Absolutely.
We have a pandemic of stress. We have people suffering illnesses due to stress. Don't tell me we don't have it. And don't tell me that the politicians understand it and have been addressing it. Stress is a pandemic in itself. It is one of the biggest causes for lost work days, for example. It is one of the biggest causes of domestic violence and other forms of social discord. It's a huge giant, right?
Absolutely. Just to pause on that point, I'm currently working in A&E. I have been over the last couple of years now. And the number of presentations I see as a result of stress is quite frightening. And that can present in a multitude of ways, whether it be physical or psychological symptoms. But in more cases than not, people who come to A&E are complaining of physical symptoms, whether it be chest pain, shortness of breath, headache, vague symptoms of fatigue. And after excluding organic causes, obviously, we come down to stress in a lot of cases. And it's quite harrowing. And that's mirrored in general practice, no more prevalent than right now. So I think that is a huge, huge giant.
Yeah, and it leads to the fifth giant, which I've written about. I wrote a book called The Precariat, The New Dangerous Class. And it just took off. It's been translated now into 24 languages around the world. It gets me all over. You know, I've done more traveling than I dare wish to do. And basically, I've said that the new class that's emerged is the precariat. And the precariat are people who are living bits and pieces lives with losing rights of citizenship, losing the rights, social rights, losing economic rights, losing civil rights. And they feel like supplicants. And the key word is supplicant, okay? It's not that they're living with unstable jobs. Of course they are, mostly. It's the fact that you feel like a supplicant. You have to ask favors. You have to please a bureaucrat or a husband or somebody or an employer or a landlord. You have to plead. And that's undignifying, and it has all ramifications. And the sense of precarity is really a giant. We have to confront it. We have to deal with it. The sixth giant, to go quickly through them, so we've put that at the back, the sixth giant are the robots. People fear being made redundant because of automation, and the advancing robots and AI and artificial intelligence and things like that. I don't believe that that is actually a reality. I don't believe we're going to be suddenly made all redundant and have nothing to do. We're a long way from that. There's plenty of work. We shouldn't be worried about that. But the technological changes are very disruptive. They cause some of the insecurity. They cause some of the inequality. They cause some of the stress, etc. And we need to make people feel more comfortable with that technological change. And a basic income would help with that. The seventh giant is the one that in my new book, which was written before the pandemic started, I said I think will be the decisive one leading to general acceptance and desire for a basic income. The others, you can all see, they're all pushing us in this direction of needing something. But the threat of extinction, which is the seventh giant, could be the tipping point. We need to feel in control. We need carbon taxes. But carbon taxes increase inequality by themselves. So therefore, only if we redistribute, recycle the money gained from carbon taxes in the form of basic income, will that be an acceptable way of dealing with global warming. But also there's a positive sense. If we had basic income, we could spend more time doing the work most of us don't do enough, the work of care, the work of voluntary work, the work of ecological cleaning and looking after nature and interacting with nature, because we could afford to do that more. It would tilt the balance towards reproductive activities rather than resource-depleting activities. And I'm very pleased that someone like Caroline Lucas, who's become a friend, who supports a basic income. She's an MP and a lovely person, and she supports a basic income 100%. And she does it from green principles, okay? So I think extinction still will be a really determining factor, the threat of extinction. The young get it. The young, educated people particularly, they care about the loss of the species. They care about the fact that we won't have enough fish to eat. We won't be able to interact with nature. We're losing good foods and so on. They care about that, and they're getting very angry. Great. I give 100% support. 100%. No, 101%. I don't care. And then the last giant is the one who's presence now, today, is particularly odious. And that's the threat of neo-fascist populism. If you have people who are fearful, who are insecure, particularly if they don't have a lot of education, they will listen to odious monsters. I called in my book, The Precariat, I said, we will see the emergence of a monster. And when November 6, 2016, huge number of people emailed me saying, your monster has arrived. And it's a fearful prospect that simplistic promises of bringing back yesterday, getting rid of the foreigners, the migrants, putting up walls, throwing them out, they're the problem, blah, blah, blah. All of that disgusting language is back, right? So here today, we have just had Donald Trump withdrawing the United States from the World Health Organization. He is trying to blame the WHO, which is under-budgeted and is a small organization and has been warning for a long time about the dangers of pandemics. Don't let him fool us. He's trying to blame the WHO for the fact that he didn't prepare the United States for this pandemic. So we have a populist trend in Britain as well. Let's not just focus on Trump. It's in Europe as well. And it's one of the eight giants. Now, in a sense, the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, is a trigger, bringing the fragile system that I've just articulated crashing down. So if we don't have a basic income, I promise you we will see a 20% decline in our national income over the next 18 months. It's got to that dramatic a point. Only if you have everybody supported will we all be strengthened. And that gets back to this sense of resilience. An individual knows what resilience means. I hope you have resilience. I hope I have resilience. In other words, if something goes wrong in one part of your system, your other part of your system is strong enough to be able to handle it, right? But if you are in a fragile state, and that's why so many people who have preconditions are dying, if you have other problems, and then along comes something like this, you die. In a sense, the system is like that. The economic system is as fragile as that. And if we have these selective measures that the government is introducing, millions of people will actually be left out. They will not get support. And if we have large groups in Britain or anywhere else not being able to be resilient, the whole system will suffer. Because they will continue to suffer from illnesses. They will continue to spread them. Our immune system as society will decline. So for me, it has become an imperative. And it's up to you and me and anybody listening to us to be pressing our politicians to get rid of their spaghetti backbones and come out in favor. That's how I feel.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, everything that you just said there regarding the Age Giants and beyond really does resonate with me, truly, because I see the product of insecurity and fear. I know that description of that fearful patient who comes in, the precarity class, who are favor asking, who are the most vulnerable and sometimes don't present themselves in that way, debt, and all these things, and how they translate into medical conditions as well as the condition of society that we have at the moment. And I think a lot of people are fearful right now, and this is quite empowering because it's encouraging us to think laterally and be a lot more imaginative than we usually allow ourselves to be.
I think that's a silver lining in the tragedy. It is forcing more people to be more innovative in the way they think. And just as you mentioned, you know, the Second World War led to the Beveridge Report and the NHS being created. And it wouldn't have been created had there not been a previous set of terrible conditions. This, I feel, is going to be transformative in this respect. Instead of supporting the financial markets, for example, which the governments have done straight away, when any crisis, they support the financial markets. So the financiers make more bonuses and more billions and they go off quite happy. Instead of doing that, we've got to remember everybody needs resilience. Everybody needs resilience. And I think we'll be able to drag the political establishment in this direction, but it's going to be a struggle because they won't do it willingly. It's going to be a struggle.
I feel like the Generation C that's being coined at the moment for the babies and the young kids of today who are going through this pandemic were really going to be the drivers of change in terms of political system and perhaps even the inception of universal basic income. What I'm trying to get my head around, and forgive me for, you know, being as methodical and practical thinking as I can, because I understand the ideology behind universal basic income, but within the construct that we have at the moment, what other things need to exist for this to actually become a reality? I.e., do we still have a welfare system, a free the point of care healthcare system, security and all the other things that we take for granted in the UK in addition to universal basic income? And what levels would taxation have to be set in order for this to exist?
Let me make it absolutely plain. I'm a total believer in good public services. 100% supporter of NHS, been a brilliant service, one of the most innovative things Britain has ever done. But if you look, as I've done and written about it in another book called The Corruption of Capitalism and Plunder of the Commons, what has been happening is a steady privatization of the NHS. Okay? We don't have the same public services today as we did at the beginning of the century. We have seen a gradual erosion of our public services. There are many places in Britain today, towns and cities, that don't even have a police station. I mean, you know, we've had a whittling away of the social state, and it's disastrous. Parks being closed or privatized, all sorts of things that have been done, okay? And I think that has to be reversed. And it's gone with systematic policy, strategy of cutting taxation, particularly taxation on wealth, on corporations. Britain does not have a wealth tax. And yet wealth inequality has been growing much more than income inequality and is huge by the comparisons of 30 years ago, for example, or 40 years ago. It's huge. If we just had a 1% tax on wealth, you could virtually pay for a modest basic income for everybody, okay? But you don't have to stop there. We need a carbon tax. If we had a carbon tax, we would be penalizing the excessive use of fossil fuels. We need it desperately. But as I said earlier, it's only a good thing if you can recycle the money, because otherwise the poor person ends up paying proportionately more than the wealthy. But we need a carbon tax. All right. And we need a land value tax. It's ridiculous that you have people, you have a duke. I love to say this, so please excuse me. You have a Duke of Buccleuch who inherited 277,000 acres of land, a lot of something for nothing, I think you would agree, and only because he's the 10th descendant of an illegitimate child of Charles II, okay? And to make the situation slightly more annoying, he's received millions of pounds from the government in subsidies to enable him to look after his land. Now, I'm not making this up. This, I've documented it in the books. You have a lot of things like that. Ian Duncan Smith, who was the architect of Universal Credit, inherited through his wife 1,500 acres of land. He hasn't done a single day's work for that. But he's received, as I've documented, he's received over £2 million in subsidies from the government. Now, for me, that's indefensible. And it turns out that the Treasury itself, not me, not Guy Standing, not you, the Treasury itself puts out a spreadsheet each year, calculating the number of tax reliefs that exist and the amount of income foregone by having them. And for your information, there are 1,156 forms of tax relief, and the Treasury can't estimate how much tax income is foregone for having those, except for the top 209 of them. Okay? And it calculates that this results in the loss to the Exchequer of over £400 billion a year. That's not me, that's the Treasury estimate. Okay? If you used half of that, you could pay everybody £150, £200 a week. So anybody who says we can't afford it is lying through their teeth or doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay? We can afford it. The good thing now is we must afford it. So I think that those things will come under scrutiny. It's crazy. For example, if I'm a landlord, I'm not, incidentally, not or ever likely to be. If you're a landlord, maybe you are. If you're a landlord and you spend on gardening, you get tax relief. Okay, if I'm with my little garden, I spend the same amount of money, I have to pay it out of my post-tax income. Okay? But if you're a landlord and you pay it, and you say you're on the upper tax rate, 45% tax rate, just to give an example, that means £1,000 spent, he can save 450. Now, where is the equity? Where is the economic rationale? There isn't any. Okay? So when people say, how are we going to afford it? I say, F off, in politer terms, I'm sure. And because we can afford it and we need to look at our priorities and the privileges that the elite get. And I think this pandemic is going, it is, I think, having a positive effect on solidarity and community spirit. You know, even Boris Johnson is trying to take credit for that. But he's voted for all these other policies for the past 10 years. He voted solidly for them. And now we're now getting it back in the eye. But solidarity is something that people are appreciating today, probably more than any time in their lifetime, right? We contact our family as much as we can. We're looking after our community. We're worried about our neighbors. We're worried about ourselves. There's a sense of coming together, but that's going to be accompanied with anger. And it should be accompanied with anger, because the inequities that have been built up, which I've documented and others have documented, are now shouting at us. And I mean, by all means, people should question things. But for me, I'm happy to give the answers because I think we've got answers.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation now, because I feel like a basic income, although it's a financial measure, it's also a small measure to sort of contribute to all the eight giants that you talked about earlier. Not alone. It's not a panacea. It's not something that's going to completely rid ourselves of all those different ailments that are so pervasive in society today. But it's certainly a step in the right direction. The skeptical side, and me playing devil's advocate, is my understanding of human nature is that we enjoy relative wealth and we enjoy the relative happiness. So if you gave everyone a basic income today of whatever it might be, let's call it £100 per week, how many times does that need to increase or change over the course of the next 5 or 10 years for it to remain novel and to remain appreciated? Because I feel, and this is getting into my perspective on the NHS, that the longer something is accepted as given, the less people would appreciate it. And I see that within the NHS with people anecdotally not abusing the NHS, but taking it for granted for sure. And it's taken a pandemic to make people actually step up and understand, you know what, the NHS is absolutely amazing. And just a few years ago, as a product of mass media, people were thinking about junior doctors as money grabbing because we had issues with our pensions and our working hours. And so there is definitely a shift in the mindset today, and that's a result of the pandemic. And that's what I'm worried about with basic income as it goes. Let's say it was started tomorrow. As it goes forward, how much does that need to change to maintain its novelty?
Well, first of all, I think people had just some justification for a sense of frustration with what was happening to the actual NHS relative to what we were brought up to think of the NHS. We all know that junior doctors in particular, nurses, auxiliaries, have been stressed because their incomes have been cut in real terms. Their benefits have been cut. Their hours of work have been ridiculously long, arduous. And actually, as we know, and I've seen the statistics, the absenteeism due to sickness is higher among medical people than among people in general, they have a higher incidence. So because they're exposed to so many risks. And the privatization has channeled a lot more of the money that's put into the health system to these private, actually mainly American corporations, United Health and so on. They're giving these very lucrative consultancies and contracts, starving the actual NHS, the people on the front line, of resources. So it's not, it's actually correct that people had a growing sense of a dissatisfaction, queues, waiting lists, etc. Okay? And how are they to express that? Of course, they express it in saying that the NHS isn't what it's meant to be, or not as good as it. And they're right, because we need pressure on a system to improve. And I think now, even Boris Johnson, after his hospital trip, now we will not see so much talk about privatizing the NHS. And we will see more talk about raising salaries, increasing benefits, reducing stress, even allowing a few more foreign doctors and nurses in. Ooh! The debate is going to be changed, okay? And that's great. It's the same with other public services. I think we're going to have a sea change in that. And that's good. I get back to your point, though, about will people get used to it and take it for granted? I think the opposite will take place. There's a famous book written by Albert Hirschman, a sociologist who died a couple of years ago. Very good book. And what he did was he looked at every social reform that he could identify and looked at the initial reactions of the majority or the politicians or whatever in different countries. And initially they said things like, you've characterized as the devil's advocate. They've said things like that, but to all and every reform, family benefits, unemployment benefits, they said the same. Pensions, they said there'll be disaster and blah, blah, blah. And then they say it will destroy other things. It will make other things like other services will go, blah, blah, blah. But as soon as it's introduced, then suddenly those objections fade. And the same people who were attacking it before tend to say, well, it's common sense. I've always supported it, blah, blah, blah. Always supported it. Oh, yes, I'm always supporting it. And then it becomes part of the social furniture, as it were. Now, the good news is that with our pilots, I've done a big pilot in India, for example, where we provided thousands of people and different communities with basic income. Once people got linked to having it and getting used to it over years, they found their behavior changed and they became better people. They said so. At the end, we did a whole lot of questionnaires. And there's a very useful example of what I call in my books the accidental pilot. And it was in North Carolina, hardly a radical place. And what happened was the Indian community, in a stroke of genius, decided that all the profits of the casinos were going to be turned into basic income payments for everybody in their community. And by chance, a local university began a child development project, which was over 20 years. And the 20-year pilot looked at child development and health and issues in families over 20 years. And the basic income payments went at the same time, by chance, right? And what happened is that it turned out one of the findings, there are other findings which I summarize in the books, one of the findings was this, that after 16 years, children who had been born in the households which received the basic income, compared with other communities where they didn't receive the basic income, the children on average were 1 year ahead in school. Their performance in school was 1 year better on average. Remarkable finding, right? And they had the data to look at why this was happening. And it turned out that the major factor, they did a lot of sophisticated regression analysis and so on with statistics and so on. The main factor was that it had created a better intra-family atmosphere. Less family stress, less argumentation, and created a better atmosphere for learning. It was the same with healthcare and the incidence of ill health. Ill health went down, healthcare went up. So in effect, people learned and behavior changed and attitudes changed. Another example is in Alaska. A man who joined our network he was a bit of a strange man. His name was Jay Hammond. And he was quirky. He was really a strange buddy. He was fun. But he became a Republican governor of Alaska. And this back in 1980s. And he said he was going to introduce the Alaska Permanent Fund, which he did. And it started paying out annual basic incomes to every Alaska resident in 1982. Right? And over the years, as the fund grew, the amount paid out rose. And to start with, people were saying, is this a good idea? Anyhow, then another Republican governor came along and he tried to use the fund for other purposes, to cut taxes and so on, and therefore channel the fund to paying for the tax cuts. And they had a recall, a public recall, if you know the American practice. He was recalled, sacked, thrown out, and another governor has promised to restore it because the people of Alaska love the scheme. They find that it's really helped reduce inequality, reduce poverty, make them have a better lifestyle, be able to afford consumer durables. And it's part of the institutional structure. They will not destroy that ethos. The governor has made a complete, mess of it. So they've got to rebuild it again. But the people of Alaska love that scheme. Those are just two examples, three with my Indian examples. I believe that once it's introduced, no government of any persuasion would dare take it away.
In that way, it's definitely got a parallel with the healthcare service that we have in the UK, for sure. And it's almost like, this pandemic is creating equal suffering across the board. Everyone is in this globally, but also nationally. And I think that equality, even though it's an equality in a negative way, is allowing kindness and community to flourish. Like the number of schemes, the number of people pouring out to the hospitals, number of people volunteering for the Nightingale, putting themselves at direct danger. It's quite incredible to see. And yes, I'm sugarcoating it. And obviously there's the negative aspect with the rising crime and a whole bunch of other things. But it's definitely the great equalizer. And it's that notion of equality, whether it be financial or otherwise, that can actually have benefits to overall community and how people function in society.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's going to be one of the compensations for the loss of life we're experiencing and the rising morbidity. I mean, most of us, if we're not directly hit, know friends and relatives who are directly hit. And that sense of solidarity and a sense of anger that this has been allowed to happen, because there's a lot of, it's not just from China, it's something that has been made worse by the lack of care for our system, our society, our care system. Look at the huge number of deaths in our care homes. That is not accidental. It's the fact that we've had a privatization of our care system. We have a huge care deficit, and we haven't been building up for the longevity that should otherwise be a blessing on society. And therefore, you know, you're having a huge decimation of our elderly population. I mean, I live a lot of time in Italy. Basically, they've had a generation wipeout. And because the Italians are family oriented, they feel it, you know, really strongly. And we in Britain are feeling it increasingly strongly. And by the time this is finished, we're going to see it much more. And that anger should be translating in demanding. We do not want to go back to what was before, the ex ante. We want a different type of society and a different set of priorities. And I think we will get it, but it's going to be a struggle. We won't get it automatically. And yeah. That's a key message I'm saying to friends and everybody, that it's up to us, every single one of us, to not only be improving our behavior towards each other, but to be demanding a different sort of politics, a different sort of social structure. And that, I think, can happen. The danger is that, you know, just as looking back after the Spanish flu and looking in the Great Depression, we have a lurch to political authoritarianism and forms of fascism. That is also possible. Okay, I think we have a 50% chance of getting a basic income, which is up from this time last year, from, I would sort of say, 20%. Now I think we have a 50% chance. But we also have a lot of right-wingers around who want the toffs to continue to rule for the benefit of the toffs. And let's not kid ourselves, okay? And we've had that, and we should be disgusted. And many of us are, I hope. But I think I'm just modestly confident.
Yeah.
Because the British are pragmatic, but we have values. We have deep values. And we understand our history, we understand our ethos, and basically I think it'll come out. I went to the north, and where was it? I was thinking town I was going, went to. I'll come back to it in a minute. But basically, this is teaching us that we owe our living standards to the many generations that came before us. Okay? And if we allow private inheritance of wealth, we should have a system of social inheritance, of social wealth. Your wealth and income, my wealth and income, anybody listening, is far more to do with the efforts of everybody who came before us than anything you or I do ourselves, right? And in that sense, I think we will have a system whereby we recognize that this is a social sharing of our collective wealth, a dividend on the collective wealth. Because I don't know whose parents, your parents, my parents, you know, or Jet Cramp, who created our wealth. We don't know. But unless you want to get rid of private inheritance, I'm not in favor of much private inheritance, but let them get rid of that first. We should have social inheritance too. And that principle, I think, is understood in Britain. The sense of our history. It's, you know, memory matters. And we owe our lifestyle to the dedication of generations before us.
Yeah, I know. And it's that that idea of not knowing where our wealth has inherited, it's come from, that I think convinces me and some of my colleagues about why social inheritance and why universal basic income is a right and should be a right rather than a fanciful idea. I think, you know, there's so many parts of universal basic income that I think would work. And particularly when we look at homelessness and crime and the effect on health and the experiments that you've done in India in particular, where it has worked and it has had some positive impacts. I wondered if you would touch briefly on the experiments that you've been privy to and had the privilege of conducting.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved. I mean, you're talking to someone who must have very strange habits, to want to punish himself, have masochistic tendency or something. But I've been privileged, if you like, to be able to put into practice, to test something which I believed, and for various philosophical and other reasons, for many, many years. In Africa, in India, in an experiment ongoing in Latin America, and in linking up in Canada and in California. Now, you don't talk to many mad people who spend much of their life doing that sort of thing, because most of us would become mad. Going out in the tropics and sitting in villages with mosquitoes around in 40-something degrees and getting people receiving basic incomes and then monitoring over several years, it takes a lot of time and energy. And you have to be objective. You have to make sure the data are collected, you know, scientifically. We use randomized control trial methodology type, so you compare over time and with other groups not receiving the treatment, as it were. And you learn. And all I can tell you is that in every pilot in which I've been involved, and in all the pilots that I know have been done in different ways, some I've just mentioned, the results are basically the same. Basically the same. The Indian one, I'll give you a list of the things we found. We provided it to 6,000 people in 9 separate communities. It's important that everybody in the community received it individually. Each man, each woman was paid individually, with the children's paid to the mother or the surrogate mother, okay? And what we observed was that there was, first of all, an improvement in the nutrition, particularly of children, okay? Nutrition improvements were greater for girls than for boys. Because often the girls had been, you know, shoved down because they were given lower priority, blah, blah, blah. So you saw a gender effect and a nutrition effect. Then there was a reduction of the incidence of ill health, small scale ill health, right? Things that are associated with malnutrition and other things. And we saw a sharp drop in the incidence of ill health. We saw over the months, over the years, an improvement in access to healthcare. And people were spending more on healthcare, little preventative measures. And as you know, as a doctor, good health starts with prevention. And you can't have preventative healthcare if you can't afford the things, right? We know that, the basics. That's why a basic income is a public health policy. It's not an alternative to public health. It's part of public health policy. And we saw improvements in health again, and healthcare, access to healthcare. And when we produced the book, I insisted that we put on the front cover a picture, a real photo of one of the women in one of the villages, and she had no legs. And when the pilot began and she started to get her basic income, she was obviously the last person in the family to receive the food and the medical treatment, etc. She had lowest priority, right? And she was in rags when we started. And why I wanted that picture on the front is she's wearing a sari and she's got a sewing machine.
right? And, excuse me, she became the seamstress of the whole community. It was beautiful. Now, when you see things like that, if you don't believe it, you're mad. Now, we saw improvements in schooling. We saw improvements, particularly among girls. We saw improvements in work. More work was being done, not less. And we saw a reduction in inequality. And at the end of the project, all the women organized a day-long march through all the villages in Madhya Pradesh that they could reach. And you had 20,000 women demanding a basic income. Now, I apologize for being emotional, but for me, to see that was beautiful.
That's incredible. Don't apologize for being emotional. That's honestly, that's touched my heart. That's amazing. We really need to try and spread this message as much as possible, because it's that description of people coming together and marching for it that I think is so, so powerful. So powerful.
We've made a video, several videos, and it does end with that march of the women. Recently, I was in Kenya. We've done pilots in Namibia. And I won't get so emotional this time, but when we did the pilot in Namibia, at the end of 2 years, I was back in the villages, and I called some young women across. They were teenagers, and, you know, I'm a white foreigner, so it was a bit intimidating. And I said to them, I said, what for you has been the best thing about having a basic income? What for you? And to start with, they were giggling. You know, they were timid. You know, they didn't know what to say. And then one of them plucked up the courage. And she said, you know, it was beautiful, I thought. You know, before, when the men came down from the fields at the end of the month with their money from their wages, we had to say yes. Now we have our basic income, we can say no. That's emancipation. And we have similar situations in Britain or in the United States, where women stay in abusive relationships because they don't have the financial security and the capacity to survive without that. And one of the results we saw in one of the Canadian pilots, which I summarize in the book Basic Income and How We Can Make It Happen, was that after a few months, critics said, look, you're causing family breakups because, you know, women and men are breaking up. And then more research showed that it was because women were walking out of abusive relationships. Is that a bad thing? Not in my book. It's a very good thing. And there are lots of positive dynamics that we have seen. And they're pretty obvious. You don't have to be an Einstein to see what happens when people have basic security. And it takes courage to want for others what you want for yourself. So in a matter of courage right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm kind of speechless. I definitely need to watch some of those. I definitely need to look into this a lot more. And I think it really does speak to me, because of someone who works in the healthcare service, who sees and witnesses what people go through and the abusive relationships. In fact, we're seeing a rise in domestic violence at the moment because of a whole bunch of the agents that you mentioned earlier as well, and that being exacerbated by the current scenario. It really... makes so much sense to me, but like you said, it's going to take a huge amount of courage and a huge amount of lobbying and marching and demand from the public who may not even understand this as an idea that can implement so many facets of our health and well-being, which is why I really wanted you to speak on this.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, it's my pleasure. But before I end, I'd love to share with you my wacky idea.
Okay.
So as someone who, you know, has been part of this movement and has been ridiculed perhaps for, you know, decades and thought, you know, this is mad, it would never work. My idea, which is perhaps small in comparison, is to make food free as a particular construct of our healthcare system and a preventative manner. I think the right food should be free for people. At the moment, we spend something around 5% in prevention in healthcare. That means 95% of our healthcare is reactive, and that's not to the detriment or me saying anything negative about our A&E system, our primary care system, secondary care, etc. But certainly, if we want to be more pragmatic preventive in a manner with healthcare, we need to make food, which is a fundamental part of preventative healthcare, free. And I think a lot of people, based on insecurities, both financially and educationally, are not privy to access those types of foods, particularly when you think about the millions of people using food banks today. And so, yeah, my idea is to make food free. I think it should be a human and public right.
Well, you can tell by my silence that I'm not persuaded, and I'll tell you why. I fully understand the motivation, and I support the motivation in the sense that we need to eat better, the sort of things that you're promoting in your program and your books. I believe in those. I strongly support what you're doing. But I think anything that's free induces wastefulness. Mm-hmm. Okay? If it's healthcare, we need healthcare, right? I mean, whether it's free or not, we're desperate to get it, right? But if you have, and I've seen systems where they give free food, right? And it leads to incredible wastefulness. It leads to a lack of respect for the resources. Because if I can get free food, I mean, I can get as much as I like and throw it away and buy some more and throw it away and the rest of it. And it leads to lack of respect by the suppliers as well. I had the dubious pleasure of working for a while as director of, in the United Nations, director of a big program, working in Soviet Union and Russia. And I saw what heavily subsidized food resulted in. It resulted in lousy quality, lack of respect by the suppliers and the purchasers. And I've seen it in India, where there's what's called a public distribution system, the PDS, where they give heavily subsidized rice, sugar, and oil, and in the villages and in their communities, okay? And it leads to terrible deterioration in quality, lack of respect for the who gets it, and most people don't get it. And it actually doesn't improve the quality. What we found in that pilot I was describing earlier is that once people got their basic income, one of the first things they did was they stopped taking the free food.
Right.
They stopped taking it because the quality was so lousy. They wanted to get fresh food, buy it in the local market, right? And I would agree with the subsidy, you know, so that you make certain foods that are known to be nutritionally better and lifestyle better, cheaper relative to processed foods and whatever. I agree with that. But if you have a basic income system, then people can learn to find their thing. There was a huge improvement, something I didn't mention earlier, in diets. Okay? There was a sharp improvement in eating fresh fruit and vegetables rather than just paddy or something. Okay? There was sharp improvements in nutrition. I think the problem you're addressing, which you're doing in your programs and your books, is partly educational. Mm-hmm. People need to be taught. We all need to be taught. I mean, none of us are too clever, you know. We all need to be taught about what is good food, what is really. And I think, you know, it's another little thing that's coming out of this pandemic. There are lots of negatives, so we shouldn't be too joyful. But is that people are learning to go back and cook decent food and experiment and grow things in allotments and in their little plots or whatever, which is the best, the essence of good food. I mean, I have a small plot and I planted more potatoes this year than any year. And you know what I mean? There's getting fresh vegetables that you pick and you eat within an hour or two. You can tell me much, much better. The nutritional value is much greater than if you get it in processed in a supermarket, all right? And I think what will happen is that localism, local markets, local shops, local barter between us. You know, you grow tomatoes, I grow cucumbers or something, and we exchange. I think it might induce improvements in diet because you are 100% right that we need to improve the way we eat. And my nose tells me that this is one thing that might, in a funny sort of way, be happening as we sit here.
Yeah.
Around Britain.
Guy, this was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. We're going to link to your incredible books as well, particularly the latest one that I think couldn't have come out at a better time right now, especially to spark a movement. If there was one parting message in a couple of sentences or so to give to the listeners, what would you say to them right now?
I would say it's up to us if we want to get it. An opinion poll has just been conducted when it showed for the first time ever that 84% of Britons support a basic income. That's incredible. But we will only get it if we put pressure to have it. I think it's coming, and it's up to all of us to do it. That's my message.
I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. Guy is perhaps one of the most humble people I've actually interviewed as well. He's been previous professors of economic security at the University of Bath, professor of labour economics at Monash University in Melbourne. He's also the director, or used to be the director of the socioeconomic security programme at the International Labour Organization. He's been a consultant for a number of international bodies, including the United Nations, the European Commission, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and the World Bank, to name a few. So please do listen, read. He's done a whole bunch of other podcasts as well on this topic. And pick up a copy of his book, Battling Eight Giants, Basic Income Now. I think it's a really thought-provoking copy, dialogue, and one that perhaps needs to reach the mainstream thinking. Maybe it doesn't achieve exactly basic income in the theoretical sense and the literal sense, but I think certainly it will shift our thinking that right now is geared towards financial growth, where we actually need to think about community growth and the other parameters that make a healthy community, both emotionally and physically as well. If you enjoyed this, please do give a 5-star review. We'd love to hear your comments. Do subscribe to The Doctor's Kitchen, and I will catch you next week. Stay safe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.